Coach, are you still hanging on to that old shooting machine that's just sitting in storage and not getting used at all? Our friends at Dr. Dish Basketball are here to help trade in your machine. Any make, any model, in any condition, even if it's from a competitor. Plus, you get an extra $250 off the Dr. Dish commercial lineup when you mention Rising Coaches.
I would say everybody wants to fast forward to the great jobs, but you got to go through some of those hard ones and survive some bumps in the road if you really want to be good in this business.
On this episode of the Rising Coaches podcast, we're joined by Mark Richman, assistant coach at Youngstown State University. Coach Richman began his journey at West Virginia as a student assistant, practice player, and manager before building an impressive coaching resume with stops at Centenary College of Louisiana, the University of Charleston, East Tennessee State, Fordham, and now Youngstown State. He also gained valuable experience leading his own program as the head coach at Notre Dame College. In this episode, we discuss the lasting lessons he learned from working under coaching legends in John Bylen and Bob Huggins, the responsibilities of a head coach that many assistants don't fully appreciate until they're in the role, and how his time as a head coach has made him a more effective assistant today.
Coaches, everyone, welcome back to another episode of the Rising Coaches podcast. Alan and Doug here, joined alongside assistant coach at YSU, special place in the heart, right? Youngstown State University. Ladies and gentlemen, Coach Mark Richman. Coach Richman, welcome.
Appreciate you guys having me on.
Yeah, you got it, man. Thank you.
No, excited to be able to get you here. I know, especially with me, it's always great to be able to talk to people back in Youngstown. I know you guys have been excelling and doing great, but the one thing that I really love to pigeonhole and talk more specifically on is just the background that you have. And I think your background actually is great because, one, you started in a student assistant position. You've been around some of the top coaches, and going into just being in your time in West Virginia, which we'll dive into that a little bit more, but you've been in a variety of roles: manager, GA, director of ops, player development assistant. You've even been a head coach too. So there's a lot of things to encompass, but when you look back on the entire journey that you've had so far, just up to this point, if you had to say one role that you feel taught you the most, whether it's all the way from head coach, all the way down to a student assistant, what type of role or what role do you feel prepared you the most for an assistant position?
I think obviously all of them, you know, play a part in it, and the people you work for certainly had a big impact on me, but I don't think there's anything that prepares you and kind of changed my outlook on being an assistant than being a head coach. Being a head coach for 5 years, and everybody says it's different, but until you go through it, you really don't totally understand it.
What was your, mine is as clear as a bell, and it's embarrassing to share it, but what was your first welcome to being a head coach moment? Mine was my first two games were a back to back with South Carolina Gardner Webb on a Friday night and then South Carolina State on a Saturday night because of a scheduling snafu with the previous staff. And so we got we did not play well against Gardner Webb and came back and won the next night. But I just remember how fast the first time out was.
Yeah, I think. So my first game was a little bit of a different experience. We had an exhibition with Cleveland State and actually ended up winning the game. So maybe I thought we might never lose one after beating a Division I to start out. But we had some injuries and some unfortunate situations that first year at Notre Dame College. Nate were coming off a conference championship, and coach had left, and I got the job and inherited some guys. It was pretty late in the summer, so kind of rolled with what we had. But that first year was definitely tough, and I think everybody says first years are hard, but it was one thing after another. It never could get it right.
Yeah. What was the biggest thing? Because I'm with you. My first year at Charlotte, we were 10-20. And we ended up finishing the season, I think, with seven guys in the rotation because we had a couple of academic casualties. But what did you, between the end of that first season and then the summer and then leading in the year two, was there one thing that you either told yourself or was there one big overlying lesson? I always like to say, if there's a way to pull some diamonds out of the rubble, if something kind of falls to the ground, there's some wisdom in there somewhere. What was that for you in that 5 to 6 months between year one and year two?
Yeah, I think you find out that being a head coach isn't as much about basketball as it is just managing people. And I think the biggest thing I took was probably the amount of decisions you have to make, whether how big or how small. You just got to make the decisions. Everybody can, so to say, row the boat in the same way, whether it's a simple decision or what time we're leaving or what we're wearing, whatever. You just got to make those decisions so everybody in the organization knows. And I think I probably didn't care about some of those things that didn't matter the first year. But I think they do in the long run. Everybody else knows kind of where to go with the program and the direction you're headed.
Yeah, I wish there were analytics that could give us an average of the number of decisions daily that a head coach makes. Let's just say it feels like a thousand. It really does. It feels like a thousand. But somebody at some point is going to come up with some analytics, like they measure touches in the NBA, the times guys dap each other up in the course of a game in the season. Somebody's going to come up with the head coach analytics on how many decisions you make on a daily basis, because it's things that people would never think of. But again, you don't know until you have to know.
Yep.
Totally. Well, and even to your point of having to know when, like, for your bus to leave for an away game, we'll say it's an hour away and maybe you leave, an hour and a half. You're going to be getting there right a half hour before. That's probably not ideal. Your guys don't get enough warm. Like, there's so many things I feel like, too, you got to – how much warm-up time do they need? If you get there too early, then your guys are going to be sitting around. Yeah, and then what are they going to do? They're not going to do much, so maybe not as productive. If you get there too late, maybe they're sleeping on the bus, so you want to get that bitch. I feel like there's so much little stuff, too, out of just that one decision, which is crazy.
Yep, especially Division II, typically playing for the women, so waiting for that game to end, you're spot on.
Then that game goes overtime. Now guys they're getting loose after getting loose.
Then you coach the game, then you gotta drive the van home.
Yeah, but then there's post game. Then there's some post game food in there somewhere as well. Where's the post game food stop at? No, it's a lot. It's definitely a lot.
So in your time as a head coach, though, as we said, it was over at Notre Dame College. So being there, did you learn anything different? Obviously, like the decisions, the back end stuff, but more maybe standing on the sidelines, the leadership, the approach of how to communicate with those guys and your staff. Did you learn anything different as a head coach from the leadership portion that you didn't know before going into it?
Yeah, I'm sure I learned a ton. You think how you want to play, being an assistant for 10, 15 years and working for a lot of great coaches. But every league's different. I would say the Mountain East, the conference we were in, is pretty much the highest. It was when I was in the league, the highest scoring, most up-tempo league in the country with the West Liberties, and Fairmont had it rolling. Charleston was really good. It was a different brand of basketball maybe than coming from Youngstown, and it was a little more possession by possession and more stoppages. I think just kind of morphing to that and kind of figuring out how we could win was the biggest thing. I think obviously, like, you want to defend and hold people to under 40% shooting, but in that league there were so many possessions it was tough to do, so you kind of had to adjust, and it took some time, but we kind of figured out a niche and we got pretty good there for a couple of years.
Yeah. Who did you lean on? Because that, to me, is one thing that first-time head coaches maybe don't know they need until they do, because it can be lonely. And you're always asking how everybody else is doing, and you need a handful of people that ask you, the need to ask you how you're doing. Because that time in your office when you need before you get everybody starts to roll in, or maybe it's at night, who were those people that maybe you could call that you leaned on to just say, hey, can I pick your brain about something? Because that, to me, that's as important as anything as a head coach. You need your sounding boards and people that can just be in your ear, or people that can tell you, no, please don't do that. I did that before. Please don't do that. So who were those people for you when you, in your first few years and moving on as a head coach?
Yeah, I think I had a handful come from Youngstown State to Notre Dame, and Jared Calhoun was the head coach, and it took us a minute to get it going at Youngstown. But I would say he was in the league at Fairmont before he went to Youngstown, so he had some familiarity with it. So he was a big influence. And I mean, on the court, he helped me get the job. So he was definitely up there. Chris Richardson from Wheeling was a good friend. He wasn't in the league at the time. Then he came in. He was at Central Missouri. And then I think my second or third year, he came to Wheeling. So now we're competing against each other in the same league. So that made it a little interesting. But he's a guy I talk to regularly. And there's a ton. We talked a little bit earlier, like Murray Bartow was a great mentor. Worked for Greg Gary at Centenary. And Greg is offensive coordinator at Purdue where all those good teams, and head coach at Mercer. Just bouncing things off those guys. But I'd probably say Jared was kind of had the most connection and the most understanding of kind of what I was going through.
Yeah, for sure. You got a nice list there, man. A couple of Rising Coaches podcast alums on your list there.
Oh, we haven't even got into the thick of it. In his beginning year, that's why I was kind of saying before when he was at West Virginia, we kind of jumped right into your head coaching stint, but we didn't even talk about your student assistant, your practice player manager time at WVU. Yep. He had a guy who we'd recently dropped, John Beilein, Coach Bobby Huggins. My guys had some legendary people around him.
Yeah, I was very fortunate. My time at West Virginia was the glory years. We were really good for a reason, obviously, on that team. Besides the two Hall of Fame head coaches, you got Joe Mazzulla playing, Mike Ganzi was playing. I told you guys earlier. Yep, Deshaun. I told you guys earlier about my high school. So I played high school with Kevin Pitsnoggle. We had some really good teams. And obviously, there's a ton of like manager guys and people that were on staff that are also in the business at various places.
Coaches from the Everhart and Larry Harrison. And wow, you've been around some folks, man. I'm glad you didn't bring that damn mascot on the pod today, because that guy almost shot me one year when I was at Ohio State, and runs around with that rifle. I felt a bullet whiz right past my head at halftime when he shoots that thing off.
I remember that game.
Oh, yeah. I'm trying to forget it.
You guys were beating us pretty good at halftime, and we turned it around in the second half.
Sure did, man. Sure did.
I wanted to go back to since we covered there a little bit, like your experiences with Beilein, with Coach Huggins early in your career, like really where it started. I know we jumped ahead to your head coaching, which we'll get more into, but I did want to talk about like the early years, because I feel like that's at least the range as to where most people resonate who are listening. And just the impact that not only those two coaches had on you, as we said, two Hall of Fame coaches, but the impact that they had on you, maybe some of the skills or traits that you took away from them, but then just your experiences of being a student assistant, how that transpired into then being a manager and progressing your career. I threw a lot at you there, but just talk about those early years and kind of some of the takeaways that you had from those two coaches.
I think about that a lot. You wish you could go back and record some of that stuff or write down more of it, because when you're going through it, I think the unique part was I was with Coach Beilein for 3 years. So I think the first year we went to the Elite Eight, second year we went to the Sweet 16, and the third year won the NIT. Won a ton of games, and as you guys know, he's obviously a mastermind and a mad scientist. I was kind of like that 16th guy, because he always had 3-4 drills going on at once and always needed an extra guy, and if somebody was out or whatever, I'd fill in. So that was kind of unique. I'm surprised guys like Ganzi and them still talk to me, because I think all I did was just foul them and grab them. But hit them with the pad. But I think a lot of people think, and obviously their delivery was very different, but Coach Beilein and Coach Huggins were so different, maybe from the outside looking in, but both were like brilliant practice coaches, game coaches. How they deliver it, like I said, was a little bit different on how it's perceived. But I think learning from both those guys and kind of seeing there's more than one way to win, more than one way to skin a cat. They were different in many ways, but at the end of the day, they had a lot of similarities and they were very successful for a reason.
Yeah, I love that you said that, because I don't think any coach is everybody's cup of tea, right?
Right.
I think everybody has got something that they bring that makes them unique, because the guys that have either worked for or played for Coach Huggins would die for him.
Okay.
And that's multiple people that I know that have been in his circle. And Coach Beilein, he was on our pod a couple of months ago and it was fantastic. And just sharing some of his you know, even some of his failures that he shared in terms of how he communicated early on. He was really candid. But in terms of each one of those guys, you mentioned the delivery because I think that's so important. And that's another thing, again, as a head coach, you don't realize is that you kind of, as an assistant, you get a lot of chances to say things to different guys on the team. As a head coach, you get one chance to say something to everybody on the team.
For sure.
And that's, to me, is the difference, right? You can move around as assistant and hit different guys all you want. But, like, when you have to send that one message to the entire locker room, you really got to think about how you deliver that. What made those two guys unique in terms of just the players really wanting to give it up for them? Because both players are extremely committed to both coaches. But talk about that. I don't know if I worded that correctly, but I think you kind of get where I'm coming from with the question there.
No, for sure. And I think your previous point, like that conversation when you're a head coach, I think that took me some time to realize as well. That conversation with your players is probably the most important conversation they have all day. That one, whether it's 10 seconds or 10 minutes, like whatever message you're relaying to those guys is probably the most important thing to hear all day. So that took me some time to learn as a head coach. But going back to Coach Beilein and Coach Huggins, I felt with Coach Beilein, we were just so prepared every day. And I think that came with practice planning, the scouting aspect of it. We probably weren't the most talented team. Obviously had some really good players. You mentioned Deshaun, and some of those guys were young when I was there. But I think just kind of the preparation and the intricacies of the offense and being a little bit different, playing some 1-3-1 and doing some of those things to mask some of your flaws is something I thought he was really good at. He found ways to win, maybe with not the most talent. We could obviously shoot the ball, so we ran great stuff for those guys. But I think that all started in practice and your preparation. And I mentioned you'd have 4 or 5 drills going on at a time and just being efficient with your practice planning and actually working on things that we really need. I thought Coach Huggins was just obviously a great motivator, and he got his teams to play harder than any teams in the country. I thought he was so experienced just being on the bench. He could see things maybe 2 or 3 possessions ahead. He had a great feel what was coming, just foreseeing that. So I thought he was like unreal in the game, just kind of having a great feel and not being scared to change, adjust, whatever. But I think a lot of people, the quote on Coach Huggins was like, he could take your 5 or the other 5 and he'd win both games. I think
that's right.
He just kind of in that game, he kind of flipped the switch. And I thought that was part of his magic. Obviously we're going to have a 3-hour practice and he's going to coach you as hard as anybody in the country. But as soon as the ball stops bouncing after that 3 hours, he's over there, he's got his arm around you, and he's just a normal person. And I don't think a lot of guys are great at that. If somebody's has a bad practice, they might be mad at him for a day or so or until you get back out there again. But he was all business between the lines. But as soon as it was over, he was great with the players and staff.
Yeah, I love that you said that. Oh, I'm sorry, Doug, go ahead. Yeah.
No, I was going to say, that's one of the things that I feel like is hard to do. My college coach was the same way. He was, when he recruited and through the early process, it was all about, this is your best friend. Oh, like he knew how to make that connection. But his first practice, I remember he was in my face, spit flying. And I'm like, this is not the same guy. This is different. But you start to realize, like exactly like you said, as soon as practice was over, he puts his arm around you like, hey, buddy, you did good today. And you were cussing me out for about an hour. There's no way I did good. But you start to realize it is really more business when you're out there. And early on, especially just as a player and as a young assistant, like I feel like you don't really catch that early, or at least I didn't. But that's one of those things where it's remarkable if you're able to do that.
Yeah. You definitely got to differentiate between the two. Obviously, it's a pressure-packed business, but we're still dealing with people. And the quote, they'll let you coach them hard as long as they know you love them. They might not feel that love maybe when you're coaching them that hard, but once you get off the floor, obviously you're back to real people.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad you said that. One, for the sake of Coach Huggins, maybe I was a manager for Gene Katie, and he used to get that label of, he must be a mean guy to be around, tough guy. He's throwing his taking his jacket off in Bloomington and throwing it into the stands, mad at the refs. But same thing. Gene Katie,
nicest guy in the world.
Has a heart of gold. Yeah, mm-hmm. Just what he did for me in terms of an opportunity as a manager. And then as I progressed in the program a little bit, forever grateful. But I'm glad you gave us a side of Coach Huggins that people never know. Because, again, it's so unfair to just judge a guy on television. Sure. When he's going off on the refs, or they maybe see him at a Final Four and they never talk to him, and he's got this straight face as he's walking through the lobby or whatever it is. But when you're around someone day to day and you know where their heart is, and like I said, what you said about practice ends, and he can go put his arm around a guy, like, that's a skill now. Like, for that, sure. That is something that we all as coaches can learn to embrace and have, because the ability to communicate, and he did it through his fire, and Beilein did it through his preparation. But they were both elite communicators. I remember trying to scout when Beilein was at Michigan, and like, his counters have counters to the counters.
No question.
With offense, it's ridiculous. But both guys, I love that you said they could both deliver it in their own way, and they're both authentic, which is really what matters at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think that's important. You got to be as a head coach. I think a lot of guys try to be somebody else, which everybody's personality is different. I think as long as you're genuine and straight up with those guys, then you can get through to them.
Yeah, I feel like if somebody tried to be like a coach who's up in your face and throwing suits into the stands and throwing chairs like Bobby Knight type, and you try to be that, but you're not that type of person, it comes off as different. You're not being you.
Yeah, kids are too smart too, right? They know.
See right through that.
Yeah, and they know if you really care about them or if you're just kind of their stepping stones for you.
For sure.
They know that as well. They definitely don't get enough credit for being as smart as they are.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt. No, and kind of, I know we did it by going to the head coaching and then going back, but I do want to make sure we touch on more of your head coaching and then going into an assistant position. I think that's something that's really relevant, and it's something that maybe a lot of people haven't done or have considered, whatever the situation might be. But you go into a head coaching position. Now, I know Notre Dame had a little bit more of an unfortunate circumstance, so obviously that wasn't necessarily maybe like the path that you were hoping to end up being.
For sure.
But going from a head coach to then being an assistant coach, just what really is like, what did that teach you? Because I'm sure it gave you a little bit more light as to, oh, I've already been in that seat. I understand what it is. He's got a lot more lights on him. So, but like, how did that help you become a better assistant?
Yeah, for sure. I think that was huge. And I think it was a big reason Coach Faulkner hired me back at Youngstown State. I had familiarity with YSU being there. So went with Jared there, whatever it was, 9 years ago. It was there the first 2 years and left, went to Notre Dame, and the school ended up closing down. Obviously a tough situation, but I think going back to Youngstown, and the job was so different from the first time we got there. Obviously you don't have great tradition and history, and then Jared kind of took him 2-3 years, but kind of flipped the script. And I think NIL and the portal fortunately helped that place. I don't know if it helps every place, but I think it kind of raised the profile of that job. And he obviously did a tremendous job flipping that thing and buying into just the new world of college basketball. But me personally, I think going back, I had great assistants at Notre Dame. When you're a head coach, obviously you need a ton of help. We talked about all the decisions you got to make. And to me, I just kind of put my head down, went back to work, and was fortunate. Like, it was a fairly easy transition. We found out literally like going into the conference tournament that the school was closing. So the timing wasn't ideal. And then a few weeks later, Jared got the Utah State job. So they had some spots open at Youngstown, and I didn't even hesitate, just kind of went to Youngstown. I wasn't even on the payroll yet. Maybe I'm not supposed to say that, but worked for a couple of weeks, just kind of turned the page, to be honest. But I think the biggest role is just taking some of those things off the head coach's plate that I didn't realize were like big decisions or, you know, things that take time. I think the hardest part was just being a head coach the first time, I think trying to help Ethan through that. And we had a good first year and had some ups and downs last year, but we're super excited kind of going into year three. And that's when I kind of felt like I got my bearings and felt super comfortable after year three. I'm hoping for a big year this year.
Yeah. No, year three at Charlotte, that was our best year. And you hate to hear that as a first-year head coach. Like, oh, yeah, hey, man, hang in there. Year three will be – it's like, wait, I got another year before year three. But no, it just – sometimes it takes a while to build some traction, especially if you're trying to build something right. If you're trying to do something that you want it to be somewhat sustainable. And I know that's in such a changing landscape we have, the word sustainable almost doesn't even fit, or it's hard to make it fit. But in terms of what you do day to day, and once they do get in the building, I think that you can make sustainable. Getting them there and keeping them is the hardest part. But once they arrive mid-June or early July or whenever that is, I think that 9 months you can make as sustainable as you can, especially now. But no, he's lucky to have you there, man, because it's such an invaluable perspective. I think you already have done it, but I think one of the best things a former head coach can do is help the sitting head coach read and feel the team.
For sure.
And if you walk in the building and you're tired one day and you know it's a Thursday and you got a noon tip off and you played Wednesday night, and your perspective on what to do that Thursday is going to be really helpful, because you're thinking about the noon tip off. You're not thinking, oh, man, we didn't play well last night. We got to do this today. We got to do that. It's like, whoa. We're tipping off again here in 48 hours. So just that perspective of, you know what? Hey, let's get in. Let's keep it short and sweet. Maybe it's film. Maybe it's shots. Maybe it's some 3-on-3 for the guys that didn't play much or whatever it is. But I think that perspective of just having been through it is so valuable. And so hopefully either head coaches that listen to this that are now assistants again, or guys thinking about hiring a former head coach at some point, it's important to understand how valuable that perspective is.
Yeah, that's, I feel like, especially with you guys too, as you said, with Youngstown State. Now, again, I know I'm from the area, so it's a special place for me, but then just seeing the growth that the program has done and then what you guys have done. But then the one thing that I want to highlight too is you even mentioned for Coach Calhoun, it took him 3 years to change a program around. And that the jumps that he's had to Utah to Cincy. So like obviously what he does is it works. But that's the one thing I feel like people overlook is if you are, and now I haven't even been in the seat yet, but if you are a head coach, it's not a 1 year deal. It's not a 2 year deal. Sometimes it's going to take time to progress, to build the culture. I feel like might be the hardest part, especially nowadays, today's landscape. It's probably difficult, or it is difficult, I should say, to build a culture because people are gone. Like you bring people in and then they're gone, and now you got to start all over again. And I just feel like that makes things way more difficult too.
No question. I think last year we had 8 seniors. We knew we were preparing for obviously a lot of turnover and only lost a couple guys in the portal, but we were an old team last year and we had some success early. Beat Akron in an exhibition and went to Grand Canyon and won. And we came back after Christmas and lost like 3-4 close games by 1-2 possessions. And it was hard to kind of get it back. So I think they've kind of turned college athletics, college basketball into, it used to be a marathon, like now it's just like you said, a 9-month sprint. And that's obviously you got to coach them and put in sets and your defense and all that. But you said it, building culture, that connectedness, that's the hardest part and the magic. And those connected teams are the ones that play well down the stretch.
Yeah, it's on their way in. And I know it's speed dating in the spring. You basically end up with 60, 70 days to put a team together. But during that time, it's almost like you almost have to take an MBA approach with the background and the research that you do, because whatever you do want to have culture-wise in that 9 months with so much turnover, you have to really try to find guys that fit that on the way in, so you're not trying to maybe teach the culture that you have so much. And if you bring in guys that fit what you're trying to build, that can help you gain a couple of steps by the time the summer starts.
For sure. for sure. You better do your homework. And you know, I think we've had some success, like recruiting guys where we knew their people, whether it was their high school coach or the previous college coach. I think that's super important. You can't go into these things blind anymore. You better have a feel, and you got to make the decision. He told us, like, this is what we were getting, so you got to be willing to deal with that. Is he better than his problems or whatever it may be? There's some risk involved, but you better do your homework and know what you're getting.
No doubt.
That, yeah. That is call the one piece.
Call the high school janitor if you need to.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, it's one piece
those guys
that
know
I
know everything.
I personally never knew it was that thorough, at least starting out when I was young. I guess I'm still young in the profession. I like that thing. Some people say I'm older now, but like, I feel when I first started out, I just was recruiting kids, and you're recruiting kids. You just go up, have a conversation with them, and I didn't really think anything of it. Now I'm starting to learn it's so much more thorough than that. Like, you have to go through so many hoops just to have a conversation with one kid. There was one kid in particular, Alan, I remember I reached out to you about, and you were like, yeah, I know this guy, call him. And then calling all these different coaches about this kid, and you're reading articles about him on the internet. And I'm just like, huh. And then you just have to go so in depth on one kid. We didn't even end up having a conversation. Like, after we had one conversation, one phone, that was it. And then I cut it from there. But it was just one of those, like, go so thorough on one kid, and then nothing even transpires from it. It's just a lot of work, but you're supposed to, and that's what you have to do in order to make sure that they're not going to be coming in like a bomb once they hit the locker room.
For sure. I think that's why retention's important. I thought we did a good job this year. I think we have one senior now. So I'm not saying everybody's going to come back, but if you do is have some of that retention, instead of taking 13 new guys or whatever it may be, you kind of know what you got. And then if you can get them for 2, 3, 4 years, then I think you're in great shape.
Coach Richmond, what we'll do is we got a little segment at the end called the hot seat segment. And really, it's just a couple quick questions. But all it encompasses is, one, you as a head coach, okay, there are a couple different questions. Number one is the lesson you feel like if you were to go back and be a head coach tomorrow, okay, what do you feel like you would be different with? Or what did you learn late in your previous head coaching stint that maybe you learned it too late, I would change this?
That's a good question. I think you got to be convicted in with what you're doing. No matter what it is, you better 1,000% believe in it. I think, obviously, we all want to try things and we see new things on the internet, and you better be 100% sure on what you're doing and what you're coaching. Because I think, like we talked about earlier, like, kids are going to see through that. If you're not sure about it, I don't care what it is, how you guard a ball screen or how you line up for the jump ball, you better be convicted in it and you believe in it 100% and coach it that way. I think being a first-time head coach, you kind of tinker with some things and you're trying to see what you like. But I think just being more convicted in those things and more direct and, like, totally believing in those things is super important. And I think the execution after coaching it that way is so much better than it is just kind of trying new things.
I like that. And then the second and really last one, would just be bringing you back your student manager days, your first stop, Centenary. I know we didn't really touch all of the other schools that you had in between, but just like your first positions in the coaching, if you had some advice in this current moment that you would give your younger self starting out in the profession, what advice would you give?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. My first job, like you said, was at Centenary. So I think I graduated from West Virginia on a Saturday and flew to Shreveport, Louisiana on a Monday for a $15,000 job. But
that's a lot.
Low. Yeah.
That could be a lot for some people.
Yeah, he was loaded at the time. You feel like a rich man. Yeah.
No doubt. But I was gung-ho. Coach Huggins was there. We're coming off a Sweet 16. I thought I was going to come back as a GA, and went in and told him about this opportunity I might have. And he said, well, you're not coming back here. And he pushed me towards that position. He said, you're going to be the youngest assistant coach in the country. And went to Centenary, and Greg was unreal. Unfortunately, while we were there, they went Division III, but I honestly think we could have got that thing going. But I think going through that, going through Notre Dame, so they went Division III. Notre Dame closed, so I'm on strike two, maybe one more. But I think You just got to be a survivor in this business. Not everything's going to go perfect. And I've been fortunate when I was in those kind of tough situations. I was patient and found a new role. But I think I learned at a young age going down there to Centenary, you can't have an ego in this business. We didn't have a ton of help, three assistants, but I was the strength coach, the ops guy, was doing a little bit of everything, but that was the best thing for me. I got to do everything as a young coach as I was progressing towards being a head coach. I had done every role. I seen the perspective of those things. I would say everybody wants to fast forward to the great jobs, but you got to go through some of those hard ones and survive some bumps in the road if you really want to be good in this business.
Makes you more well-versed, especially like when you were, as you were saying, you're the coach, you're the Dobo, you're the strength coach. Like, you're learning about all those things. Maybe you don't necessarily know them at the time, but once you get thrown into those, now you got to do research. You got to at least learn about them if you're going to be doing them. And now that makes you more well-versed, more marketable later on down the line, you more knowledgeable too. So I think that's always a good thing. And why I always tell people too, starting a lower profession like a Division III or Division II is always good because it gives you those opportunities to learn so much more. So that once you get into an assistant position, you don't have to worry about all the little stuff. You just focused on one thing.
For sure.
But first off, thank you again for hopping on here with us. Obviously, it's great to see you. I know I get to run into you guys occasionally throughout the year at the camps and catching some games, practices. So look forward to watching to see what you guys got going on this year. But also, thank you very much for hopping on here with us.
Appreciate you guys having me, and thanks for what you guys do. I'm a listener and follower, so I'm looking forward to this one coming out.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you, man. Go Penguins, man. Let's go Penguins.
Go Gwins, baby. To everybody out there, thank you all, as always, for tuning in. And that does it for another episode of the Rising Coaches Podcast. Alan and Doug, coaches, all of you, keep working, keep rising. We'll see you all soon. I want to thank all our listeners for tuning in with us this episode. If you are not a member, want more content, or even be a potential member on our member spotlight to have your story heard, go visit risingcoaches.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and X at Rising Coaches. And don't forget to subscribe, leave a rating, and review so we can continue to keep rising together.
Still hanging on to that old shooting machine that's just sitting in storage and not getting used at all? Our friends at Dr. Dish Basketball are here to help trade in your machine. Any make, any model, in any condition, even if it's from a competitor. Plus, you get an extra $250 off the Dr. Dish commercial lineup when you mention Rising Coaches.